The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
She's got the news. She talks with newsmakers. She encourages us to laugh, and she cries with us. Speaking truth to power and questioning authority daily, it's the Nicole Sandler Show.
All right. Hello, and welcome to a Friday. Oh, I love it when we make it to the end of a week. I was going to say unscathed, but there's nothing unscathed about what we're all going through right now. All right. Well, it is a Friday, and today's a day I have been looking forward to for quite some time. Because as you know, over the last month or two, I've spoken with former Alabama Governor Don Siegelman on a few occasions. I've also been reading his new book. The book is called Stealing Our Democracy: How the Political Assassination of a Governor Threatens Our Nation. And let me tell you, it does. Indeed, it does. I finally finished reading the book last night, and it made me cry, because what happened to a really good man should never have happened to anybody in this country. It is a travesty. And an even bigger travesty, perhaps, is that this story has not been screamed from the rooftops in every city around the nation. Now, I remember when this happened to Don Siegelman. During that time, I was doing talk radio here in South Florida. Then I moved to Air America, where we covered this incredulously. And as much as I remember most of the details, most of what happened as this all went by, reading the details and reading Governor Siegelman's explanation of what happened, seeing all the behind-the-scenes maneuvering and what was done to this man is just reprehensible. It makes me so angry. And so I invited the governor back today to really go in depth into his story, because we've heard it in bits and pieces and bits and spurts. And the book lays it all out. I want you to buy the book. It is officially released this coming Tuesday. It's available for pre-order at all those usual places. But you must read this book. And stick around, because Governor Siegelman will join us in just a couple of minutes. We got a little bit of news to take care of, and I want to play for you. I like to try to start each show with something lighthearted and fun, something to give us perhaps a little laugh, if that's possible in this day and age. So what I've been playing mostly over the last few months are song parodies that I found online, mostly people dealing with the COVID infection in a somewhat humorous way. This one is something different. It's an old friend, Jill Sobule, who's been on this program many times and is an old friend of mine from back in my music radio days in Los Angeles. And she posted this video to her website last night. It works on a lot of levels, and it especially works with what we're dealing with today. So we'll open the show officially with this new song from Jill Sobule, and it's called Owning the Libs. You can guess where she's going with this one. Take it away, Jill Sobule. Uh-oh. Yeah, here we go. I think. No. Oh, no. It doesn't want to play. Oh, no. Best laid plans and all that. You know what? For some reason, I'm not getting any audio out of there, which is really weird. So I'm going to have to play for you the audio version of the song, because I can't tease you like that and then not play it for you. So here we go. Jill Sobule. Oh, no. Give me one more second. Oh, best laid. You knew I couldn't get through a show without a technical problem today, right? All right. Final go. Here we go. Jill Sobule giving it to the libs.
To the rally, I took all the kids. We wear our hats proudly, giving it to the libs. Went to church last Sunday, you know what I did? I hugged everybody, giving it to the libs. I'm giving it to the East Coast, giving it to the West. Here we know in Idaho, we don't blah, blah, blah. No, I'm not sick. Can't think of a better way. Giving it to lips. I'm giving it to Hollywood, New York City, New Orleans. Have you got your government check yet? Mine I haven't seen. I went to the Hobby Lobby. I took all the kids. We touched everything inside. I'm giving it to the lips. 3 weeks later, I woke up this morning. I could barely breathe. Mercury rising 103. Now I'm in the ER waiting for a bed. The nurse, she wears a garbage bag. The guy next to me is dead.
Oh, no.
I'm giving it to my cousin, her poor husband too, my niece with diabetes, and I'm giving it to you. I went to church this Sunday, and you know what I did? I got buried in my maggot. I'm giving it to the lips. I'm proud to be an American. I'm giving it to the lips.
That is...
Boom.
Jill Sobule, and she's just awesome. Giving it to the libs, a little bit of entertainment to a little bit of levity in light of our crazy situation. Great stuff, always from Jill Sobule. All right, little bit of news before we get to Governor Siegelman, and it is what's going on is just astounding. And I'm not gonna spend too much. You can always listen to What's News, which is posted at NicoleSandler.com and also a podcast. So here we go. Little bit of what's happening today.
I read the news today. Oh boy.
All right. I'm not going to get into much of it because I want to get to Governor Siegelman. But let's start with this. Looting has broken out in Washington, D.C. again. And this time we knew it was going to happen. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin is now flat out refusing to disclose the businesses that received $5 billion in bailout funds through the Paycheck Protection Program, claiming the information is confidential. 4.5 million businesses received government funds. And normally, the Small Business Administration discloses the names of borrowers from the program on which it based the PPP. But Steve Mnuchin said his department considered that information proprietary and confidential. Wow. And this has a little bit of bearing on some of what I'll be talking to the governor about. The Republican-led Senate Judiciary Committee yesterday authorized its chair, Senator Lindsey Graham, to subpoena former Obama administration officials about the origins of the intelligence community's investigation into Russian election meddling. In a party-line vote, the panel's Republican majority approved calling former Director of National Intelligence James Clapper, former CIA Director John Brennan, and the Senate Intelligence Committee concluded in a study recently, which might be also one of the reasons why Richard Burr was pushed out, the Senate Intelligence Committee concluded that Russia did try to interfere in the 2016 election on Trump's behalf, But Lindsey Graham wants to also look into foreign surveillance applications and why former special counsel Robert Mueller was appointed in the first place. So they're issuing all these subpoenas. Of course, if you remember back to the Mueller investigation, all of the Trump administration officials denied the subpoenas. So the Democrats, of course, are suggesting that they subpoena as well some current and former Trump allies, including former Attorney General Jeff Sessions and Trump's son-in-law and senior advisor, Jared Kushner. Also, heading down to Louisville, Kentucky for a moment, the Metro Council there voted unanimously yesterday to ban the type of no-knock search warrants that police were using when they fatally shot Breonna Taylor of course, the unarmed black emergency medical technician in her apartment while she lay sleeping in her bed on March 13th. Her boyfriend fired first, thinking the officers were intruders. Well, the mayor, Greg Fisher, who suspended the use of those no-knock warrants last month, said he'd sign Brianna's law immediately, tweeting out the risk to residents and officers with this kind of search outweigh any benefit. That's true, but I want to know why those three cops who shot and killed Breonna Taylor are all still walking around. Two more quick items. Donald Trump appeared last night or yesterday in Dallas, Texas, at an event billed as a race roundtable that he was allegedly going to lead. It was held at a conservative and predominantly white church in Dallas, at which Trump praised the National Guard's use of tear gas and other forceful measures to disperse Minneapolis crowds who were protesting police brutality against African Americans. He described the effort to quell a protest as a, quote, beautiful scene, and described where the National Guard walked through like a knife cutting butter. Ugh. Now, Trump did not mention the name George Floyd, but he said that the work of confronting bigotry would go quickly and it'll go very easily, providing we avoid falsely labeling tens of millions of decent Americans as racist or bigots. You got to be kidding me. And by the way, Dallas, Texas has a black police chief, a black sheriff, and a black district attorney, and none of them were invited to participate in a roundtable on race and policing held in Dallas, Texas, with the President of the United States. It is just unbelievable. And now we learn that the Orange Menace will accept his Republican nomination in Jacksonville, Florida in August instead of in Charlotte, North Carolina, as originally planned, because Donald Trump wants a big crowd. He wants a packed convention center with no masks, by the way. And North Carolina's Democratic governor said, hell no, the instances of COVID-19 are spiking. You're not doing this in my state. And so the Florida man in chief, Governor Ron DeSantis, obviously cares more about appeasing Trump than the health and safety of Florida citizens. So now Republican delegates will elect their nominee from Charlotte, where most of the convention business will still happen. But Trump will make his acceptance speech three states away in front of what he expects will be a packed arena filled with idiots without masks. But this date also coincides with another horrible day in history in Jacksonville. It's the 60th anniversary of the Axe Handle Saturday, when a white mob organized by the Klan attacked mostly black civil rights protesters who were sitting at Jacksonville's whites-only lunch counters. Can this administration be that tone deaf? And you know, this is not the first instance. Trump will hit the campaign trail long before that with his first stop scheduled in Tulsa, Oklahoma, the site of one of the worst acts of racist violence this country has ever seen, next Friday, a week from today. That is June 19th, Juneteenth, a day that commemorates the end of slavery in the United States. Again, they knew what it meant, and reports say, you know, they knew of the Tulsa history, they knew of the date, but they didn't think the backlash would be so bad. Right. By the way, if you want tickets to that Tulsa rally, you can now get them. The campaign formally offered supporters the chance to register to attend, but they're requiring that anyone wishing to go first agree not to sue the campaign or the venue if they contract COVID-19. I kid you not. The online sign-up page says anyone clicking to register for free tickets acknowledges that there is an inherent risk of coronavirus infection. Quote, by attending the rally, you and any guests voluntarily assume all risks related to exposure to COVID-19 and agree not to hold Donald J. Trump for President Incorporated, Box Center, ASM Global, or any of their affiliates, directors, officers, employees, agents, contractors, or volunteers liable for any illness or injury. That's how little regard this president holds his supporters Forget about the people who don't like him. This is what he's doing to his supporters. They could get sick. So what? As long as they're there cheering me on. Our system is broken, horribly so. And if you think it only started during the Bush, during the Trump administration, you're sorely mistaken. And this hour, we will relieve you of those notions. We're just going to get right to him. I promised you Governor Don Siegelman, and I'm thrilled that he joins me now. Hello, Governor. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, Nicole. I could listen to you all day long.
Thank you.
It is both informative, and I was smiling most of the time because if anybody doesn't believe that our democracy is being stolen, they just need to listen to your broadcast. I mean, how can the Treasury Secretary keep from the public how they're spending $5 billion of our money?
And, you know, this was brought up in the negotiations over the CARES Act, that the businesses that received the PPP funds had to be disclosed. And they sort of just pushed it off. And frankly, shame on me, I didn't follow it closely enough. But if I had, I guess I would have seen that Steven Mnuchin never agreed to make that information public, as has always been done in the past.
Well, let me I'm going to jump from here back to Breonna Taylor.
Okay.
And the three police officers who shot and killed her. Mm. And the reason they're still walking on the street is covered in my book, Stealing Our Democracy. And let me explain why this is relevant, why my book is relevant to what has happened to George Floyd, Eric Garner, Trayvon Martin, and so many others that have been killed before and since. It is because our system, our grand jury system, allows prosecutors to set cops who kill people free in the secrecy of a grand jury. They can be no-billed by not presenting evidence to the grand jury that they're guilty, but by presenting evidence to the grand jury that makes the homicide look like it's justified. And that's why we see so few police who have been involved in fatal shootings of innocent citizens convicted or charged with anything. And so in my book, Stealing Our Democracy, I talk about reforming our justice system. One of the key elements is to ensure that both targets of grand juries, such as myself, as I was back in 2002 through 8 or whatever it was, or the family members of victims, such as Breonna Taylor or Eric Garner or George Floyd, have the right to have a lawyer present in the grand jury as a check on truth. Now, why do we need a check on truth? Because there is no judge present. It is a secret proceeding. And the United States Supreme Court has given blanket immunity to prosecutors to willfully and intentionally present false evidence or withhold exculpatory evidence to get an indictment or a conviction. I'm not making this up.
No.
In the Los Angeles Times on January the 5th, 2010, the legal correspondents for the LA Times reported that President Obama's lawyer argued to the United States Supreme Court yesterday, January the 4th, 2010, that U.S. citizens do not have a constitutional right not to be framed.
We need to just stop on that for a second, because that's one of the many things that I dog-eared the page and highlighted in your book. President Obama's Solicitor General made this argument that U.S. citizens do not have the constitutional right not to be framed.
It's also been embedded in congressional acts, the Federal Tort Claims Act, which also gives prosecutors a free hand to present false evidence to get a conviction or to get an indictment. The now let me say two things. One, Elena Kagan had her deputy make the argument, and it was a legal fact that U.S. citizens can be framed. But the fact of the matter is, the Solicitor General did not have to take that position. Mm-hmm. She could have taken another position and said, you know, this is the law today because of a 1976 Supreme Court decision, but we're asking you to change that decision today. This involved two black men who spent 25 years in prison for a crime they didn't commit. They were suing for monetary damages. Now, let me take you one step further into the legal minutiae, and I'll get out of it. But in a civil deposition where monetary damages are at stake, lawyers from both sides have an opportunity to object to evidence that the other side seeks to introduce, mm-hmm. or testimony, and a judge decides whether or not it can be introduced. Well, that's where money is involved. But shouldn't we have that same legal protection where someone's life and liberty is at stake?
Yeah.
The answer, yeah. So that's one of the recommendations I make in my book. But if anybody needs proof that if they don't believe that our democracy is being stolen, you know, look at what's going on today. I mean, here you have Donald Trump calling in the military to go out and gas protesters because he wants to have a photo op. Or, you know, Bill Barr has made so many decisions that underscore that the Department of Justice can be politicized or can be weaponized to a president's will. And we've simply got to, you know, hold both police, prosecutors, and presidents accountable for their abuses of power. So far, we have done a miserable job of that.
Absolutely. Well, that's an understatement. Governor Don Siegelman, of course, is our guest. The book, Stealing Our Democracy, How the Political Assassination of a Governor Threatens Our Nation, officially hit stores on Tuesday. And again, it is a tale that should be taught in schools to show the breakdown of the rule of law, that shows how corrupt individuals can game a corrupt system and how the protections that are supposed to be in place are not there. So, Governor, I set aside a lot of time today. We have the whole rest of the hour and then some if we need it. I really want to go through your story because, as I said at the beginning of the show, I remember when this was happening to you. I was doing talk radio here in Florida, then on Air America, and you know, listen to what happened in disbelief when you got sent back to prison. We'll get to this. It was just it was a knife through my heart. I can only imagine what it did to you. Well, I saw some in reading the book and getting into your head and how this affected you and your wonderful family. It's just what was done to you was just horrible. And so I do want to, a lot of time has passed, and there are a number of people who've come to embrace the news and politics late after what's been going on in our world that may not know your story. And it's so important that they know what was done to you, because we're seeing it sort of repeating itself with the Trump administration as his cronies and his sycophants are possibly worse than Bush's. But I you know, it bothers me when I see, in comparison to Donald Trump, people saying, oh, Bush wasn't so bad. Well, he was that bad. And the people he surrounded himself with were that bad. So let's start with the beginning. You were a very popular Democrat in Alabama. You were Secretary of State. You worked your way up to Attorney General, then Lieutenant Governor, and eventually became governor. And you were so popular, not only among the Democrats, but among Republicans too, that your name was being floated as a potential Democratic presidential candidate for 2004. That's until Karl Rove got involved, right?
Correct. Yeah, and I want to give some perspective, because my being elected to public office wasn't an easy feat, right, considering that I was running in probably the most conservative or one of the most conservative states in the country. And, you know, I was a Robert Kennedy, Jane Fonda Democrat.
You're a progressive. You are a progressive. And I need to make that clear to the people listening. There are some Democrats, you know, Doug Smith has a cameo in your book, the current senator from Alabama, who is a Democrat, but not a progressive. You are a progressive. You're one of us. And that's why I take this so personally. I'm sorry. Continue.
Well, I was elected to the National Board of the Americans for Democratic Action. It's a noted liberal organization, grew out of the socialist movement in the 40s. I was elected to their national board in 1971. I worked in the Don Johnson movement. I worked in the Al Lowenstein, who ran for Congress on Long Island. I graduated from Georgetown, went to Oxford, England. One of the former governors told me I should tell everybody that was Oxford, Mississippi. They'd like that a whole lot better. But I came back and I worked against George Wallace's attempt to take over the state Democratic Party. But anyway, I found myself being elected. I was drawn into public office because I wanted to change things and make things better for people. And I did have a good run. I was the longest running elected Democrat in the Southeast at the time that I had decided that I'd had enough of George Bush's war policies, his senseless education and economic policies, and that I had to enter the primaries, starting in South Carolina, as a Southern progressive, kind of along the lines of Carter and Clinton, to break the Republican stronghold on the South. And I think it was at that point that Karl Rove decided enough is enough. And I was targeted for prosecution by Karl Rove's client, the state attorney general. Now, if you want me to, I can go ahead and go through a litany of Rove connections to my case, but I wanted to give you a chance to go and ask a question.
Yes, and actually,
you wanted me to go in a different direction.
No, thank you. And I first need to correct myself. Two things. It was $500 billion in the PPP program. I said $5 billion at first because the number is so astounding. And I just wanted to make that correction because it was $500 billion that they refused to tell us where it's going. And the senator from Alabama is Doug Jones, not Doug Smith. I was having a brain fart. But please.
Well, it's a common name.
Yes, I knew it was something like that.
I was going to let it pass.
Yeah, I hate when I get something wrong, I like to correct it. And please do point out if I screw something up. But yes, the tangled web around Karl Rove is important because the people that he enlisted to carry out his dastardly deed were all involved throughout your whole time in politics in Alabama, from Laura Canary, the prosecutor, to her husband who worked. So do tell us the players, because we should do a flow chart because there are a number of them involved.
Let me say two things. All right. First of all, there may be people listening who are not familiar or not familiar enough with Karl Rove.
Right.
He was the architect, they say. Bush presidency.
He was
Bush's brain. During Bush's presidency. Mm-hmm. He was a political operative. He was raised by Lee Atwater. But he has a sordid past that goes back to Richard Nixon when he worked in the Nixon White House, doing dirty tricks even before then. But he worked with George Herbert Walker Bush in his reelection in 1992. His sidekick, the guy that was in charge of the ground troops for the Bush Quail campaign, was a guy named Billy Canary.
Right.
He had worked with Reagan and Bush. And anyway, so after the 92 election, after they lost to Bill Clinton and Al Gore, Rove and Billy Canary came to Alabama because Billy Canary had a girlfriend there. they decided they could set up a political shop in Alabama, start over. And so they did. Rove moved to Rosemary Beach in, on the Gulf Coast, and Billy Canary moved to Alabama. They both married Alabama girls and settled in for the long haul to rebuild their political future by taking over the Alabama Supreme Court. I had, of course, indirect run-ins with them periodically from 1994 until the year 2002. But in 1999, after I'd been elected governor, an investigation was started by Karl Rove's client, the state attorney general, Bill Pryor, who now sits on, he's the chief judge of the 11th Circuit of the, wow. Supreme, of the Alabama, of the Court of Appeals in Atlanta. And when my when I was running for office in 2002, the night of the election, I won, but a second and third set of returns were produced by the probate judge, sheriff, and circuit clerk that essentially wiped out 6,200 of my votes and gave the election to my opponent.
Right. Again, just to stress what happened here, that the polls closed, the first, you know, the precincts, everything was counted. You won. It was 11 o'clock at night. Everyone went home. Later on, all of a sudden, new numbers came from the Republican headquarters or something, where somebody in the dead of night switched the numbers from a few of the polling places, and all of a sudden, you were behind. And they certified those numbers before the deadline without anybody ever seeing those ballots. Yes?
Yeah, I when I realized what was happening, that they were stealing the election, I called and requested a hand recount of the paper ballots in this one precinct where my votes went missing.
Right.
Before we could get to this South Alabama county the next morning, the state attorney general, Karl Rove's client, had seized the ballots and seized the cassettes from the voting machines in each count, in each precinct, took all of the election supplies and went to Montgomery and certified my opponent as a winner. And you noted illegally, because they weren't supposed to be counted or certified until Friday noon after the election.
Right.
The mystery starts to unfold a little more clearly when we have evidence that Jack Abramoff, who is one of Karl Rove's three college Republican buddies, the other two, Grover Norquist, and Ralph Reed.
Oh, lovely. What a trio.
But all three of them were involved in funneling $20 million of Indian casino money from Mississippi into Alabama in an effort to defeat me and to defeat a ballot initiative which I had proposed, which would have provided for free college education for all of Alabama's children.
Now, right.
And free universal pre-K early learning for
now,
all of
this Alabama's. This education fund, this ballot initiative, was for a lottery, which many states have. State lotteries go to benefit education. And this was a project. This was a pet project of yours that you had been working on for a long time. And they chose that to go after you on. And keep in mind, again, that this was a state lottery program you wanted to put into effect to benefit education in your state, and they turned it around and accused you of taking a bribe.
The bribe, Nicole, was based on a campaign contribution to the ballot initiative, to the campaign fund for the ballot initiative.
Right.
And it was alleged that I had made a deal to put the contributor back on a board, from which he had resigned, by the way, back on a board on which he had served for 12 years under three previous governors.
And that he didn't want to go back to, but he did it because you asked him to. It was not like, this is a favor. You give me a contribution, I'm going to name you to this board. He had already served on it, and he really didn't want to do it anymore, but he said he would because you asked him to.
Right. He said he would do it for a year, no more, and that was that's what he did. But, yeah, there was no allegation of any self-enrichment scheme or no allegation of any personal benefit to me whatsoever. But the judge told the jury that they could consider the contribution to the ballot initiative as a thing of value to me because I supported free college education for the for our kids, and that was this, that was the source of the money for the education.
Okay, so now was, you're talking. They're saying that constituted a quid pro quo. Now we've all learned a lot about quid pro quo through the deal with the Ukrainian president, where Donald Trump said, "You open an investigation into Biden, and we'll give you the aid, the financial aid that you've been needing." That's quid pro quo. What you
that's an express quid pro quo. And that's the kind of quid pro quo that the Supreme Court said in 1991 in the McCormick case would constitute a bribe.
Right.
But yet when the U.S. Senate, the Republicans in Senate were confronted with that, they changed 100 years of history and said, oh, no, that's not a bribe. But in my case, when there was no quid pro quo and there was no personal benefit, I was convicted and sent to prison for 88 months for trying to help the kids of Alabama. But it was all a facade. It was just an attempt to get me out of the way because they didn't want me in that 2004 presidential race. But the, you know, so there are two comparisons. We made one to the quid pro quo, mine non-existent, and Trump's expressed.
Very much so, yes.
But the other point of this is, and one that I wanted to make in the book, and I think I did, is that the Department of Justice can be used as a political weapon. It was during the Bush administration to come after me. They also went after Jim Doyle in Minnesota, was it? I'm not sure. But anyway, he was a governor from a Democratic governor as well. And then they fired Republican U.S. attorneys who would not go after Democrats.
Right. We remember that.
To bolster the Republican.
And these were U.S. attorneys who had been appointed by George W. Bush. They weren't holdovers from the Democrats. It was his own appointees who weren't doing his political bidding enough. So they'd had a mass firing, and that was a big controversy that I remember very clearly. Well, this is all, go back, continue.
Yeah, there were 17 editorials in the New York Times about my case and about the need to investigate Karl Rove's involvement. And John Conyers, bless his soul, was hot on the trail. He was the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee. And he wanted Karl Rove to testify under oath about the firing of the U.S. Republican U.S. attorneys and also the selective prosecution and political misconduct, prosecutorial misconduct in my case.
Well,
Rove would never agree to testify under oath. And unfortunately, when President Obama was elected, they gave him a pass and allowed him to speak to Adam Schiff as a member of the House Judiciary Committee, but not under oath. And even during that time, when they asked him about Billy Canary, he said, "I don't know if I remember him or not." Well, clearly he was lying, but he wasn't under oath, so it wouldn't make any difference.
Right. Oh.
And then they asked him about another one of his deputy at the White House. Her name was Kitty McCullough or Kelly Kimbrough. She changed her name. And he claimed he didn't really know who she was either. But she was not only working for him at the White House, she was working for him on the ground in Alabama, directly overseeing my election, a re-election in 2002. She was sitting at the desk with the Republican Party chairman when they called the Baldwin County probate judge and said, y'all got to do something about this vote in Baldwin County, or otherwise our candidate for governor is going to lose and Sigelman is going to win. It was then that they went back in and made the change in the vote total, after which, again, Karl Rove's client seized the ballots before they could be counted and took them away and certified my opponent as the winner.
At that point, Governor, somebody should have stepped in. Who should have stepped in to fix this mess at that point?
Well, at that point, that was 2002, the White House and the Justice Department and the U.S. attorneys were controlled by George W. Bush. Mm-hmm. But you would think that the DNC or members of Congress would have gotten so exercised about this that they would have started an investigation and would have demanded that those ballots be turned over to somebody so we could have a recount.
And that never happened.
But nothing was done.
Amazing. So,
the point I want to make is, and the point I make in my book, is that my election was hacked. It was done through a computer, and it was the guy that took credit was a staff member of Bob Riley's, my opponent, who claimed he was an elections security specialist, trained by the software company that operated the machines in Baldwin County. And he went to work immediately after the election for a Jack Abramoff and Tom DeLay-related lobbying firm, the Alexandria Group. The point I want to make is that elections can be stolen today through hacking, and it doesn't have to be the Russians.
Right.
It can be Karl Rove's buddy, or it could be somebody else's. And now, back to the point I made at the beginning of your program, we now know that President Bush has extended a hand, or maybe I didn't make this point, I wanted to, President Trump has extended a hand to Karl Rove to come to the White House. They have kissed and made up because they were angry at each other in 2016. And now why would President Trump need Karl Rove? Because he is a whiz kid at
stealing elections,
either stealing or causing elections to fall to Republicans.
Yep.
And direct evidence in Alabama in 1994, when I say he stole the election for the Chief Justice of the Alabama Supreme Court, by getting some 2,000 what I thought were valid absentee ballots thrown out. Mm-hmm. And then he was involved, of course, in creating the chaos around the 2000 election between Bush and Gore in Florida.
Yep.
And he is an expert at this. And in 2020, when we're going to see a massive number of absentee ballots being cast, you can bet that Karl Rove will have people at every county courthouse throughout the country to challenge absentee ballots that are coming in from Democratic controlled precincts. They're going to try to suppress and have as many of those ballots thrown out as possible to help swing the election back to Donald Trump. The other thing you can watch is that Ralph Reed, with his bogus Christian coalition, is probably going to be trying to, get the evangelical Christian right involved in the Trump campaign, and he'll be beating those drums to get out the vote. So we've got a job on our hands to protect our democracy. And that's what my book is about.
Right. And that's why it's so imperative that people know what happened. To paraphrase Trump, if you ignore history, you're bound to repeat it. We need to not only make sure this is not repeated, but I think Karl Rove and Bill Canary and Laura Canary and everybody involved with what they did to you needs to be held to account. But we'll get to that. So 2002, your reelection was derailed because they stole it from you. And then while you're living with
them,
you're indicted.
No.
No. What happened?
Well, all right. Well, yeah, we've got to, there's a little more background to the story that's interesting.
Yes.
So in 2003, when my Republican opponent took over as governor, he immediately proposed a tax increase that even the state Republican Party opposed. His popularity dropped. The political surveys that were done immediately around that period of time showed that in a head-to-head contest with me in 2006, that I would win by like 66%. So the Republican Party chairman then went to Washington to see Jeffrey Beauregard, General Sessions. Beauregard Sessions.
Oh, yes.
And I say he's named after the Confederate general, by the way.
Right.
So he goes to see Jeff Sessions and convinces him that he's the only person who can run for governor on the Republican side who can beat me in 2006. Jeff Sessions had served as U.S. attorney in Mobile, South Alabama. His contingent of FBI agents, several of them, resigned and came to work for the state as independent investigators. They were eventually hired by the state, and it was those retired FBI agents who had worked for Jeff Sessions who investigated me for nearly 4 years, trying to build these bogus cases while Sessions himself was considering running against me for governor. The first case came in 2004, and the judge who had been on the bench for 29 years said it was the most unfounded criminal case over which he had presided in his entire service on the bench, and it was dismissed with prejudice. And then shortly after I announced I was running, my official announcement that I was running for governor in 2006, I was indicted again, this time on the bribery charge. And you know the history from there. I was convicted and sent to prison I spent 5 years in prison.
Right. Now, there was a time you were let out because you were let out on appeal where a three-judge panel from the Circuit Court of Appeals said, wait a minute, this is bogus, let you out in advance of the retrial. And during that time, it looked like, you know, you're going to prevail because you didn't do anything wrong.
Yeah.
Right.
It did look like I was going to prevail. What happened? 60 Minutes, and I give them credit for this largely because Scott Pelley had a 12-minute segment on February the 24th, 2008, where they had first a Republican Attorney General from Arizona, who had been John McCain's campaign manager, co-chairman in 2000, who said that, you know, this Alabama was one state where they couldn't beat Sigelman fair and square, so they targeted him with this prosecution. Then they interviewed the witness that had Nick Bailey, who was the real crook in all this, and he said, he told 60 Minutes that he had either spoken to or been spoken to investigators or prosecutors over 70 times over the course of some 4.5 years. And he had been made to write and rewrite his proposed testimony over and over until he got his answers the way the government wanted them. There was a government paralegal present, Tamara Grimes, a Republican, who gave a sworn statement, a whistleblower statement. And she said that she was present while that particular witness was coached and cajoled and pressured to remember things that he clearly did not recall.
Wow.
So that's how the government got its conviction. And the charges were initiated not by the FBI, but by Jeff Sessions, retired FBI agents. I was brought to trial 1 month before the 2006 elections by the U.S. attorney whose wife, whose husband was Karl Rove's business partner, Billy Canary. So while I was being investigated and charged, the U.S. attorney's husband was connected to Karl Rove, but he was also running my opponent's campaign. He was the campaign manager for my opponent.
And there are so many instances like this that are just so wrong that in a normal court of law would have a case thrown out immediately. Conflict of interest. But you had a judge, Judge Fuller, who was so against you from the start that on every front, I mean, you were not allowed to even bring up the idea that this was a political prosecution. You weren't allowed to mention politics in your defense. I mean, I would think that on appeal alone would have the case thrown out.
Yeah, you would think also that this was revealed after my conviction, but John Conyers was pressing the Department of Justice for an investigation. They sent a letter, a sealed letter, to the House Judiciary Committee that was released by an anonymous whistleblower in the, I guess you can have an anonymous whistleblower, in the House Judiciary Committee staff. It was published by the Project on Governmental Oversight. And in the letter from the Department of Justice to John Conyers, they said, politics was not involved in Sigelman's prosecution, but the lead prosecutor conducting the investigation was emailing Sigelman's opponent's campaign manager, giving him updates on the Department of Justice investigation. Now, I don't know what you would call that, but the Department of Justice said it wasn't political, and it wasn't political that the U.S. attorney's husband was working for my opponent and managing his campaign. So anyway, we have a lot to straighten out in this country. And, you know, I'm sorry that I was the guinea pig, but I wrote this book so I could expose some of the wrongdoing, but the book is not about me. It is about saving our democracy. What happened to me happened. We can't erase it. I can't go back. I'm not governor. I'm not going to be governor. I'm not going to enter the presidential race. But, you know, we've got to protect our democracy from these kinds of abuses of power. Now, let's take it down to George Floyd and Eric Garner and okay. Breonna Taylor.
Before we will, one more thing I want to get at, though. You point so many figures, and the last time we spoke, the last two times we spoke, it was about problems, for instance, those people still in prison who are at such great risk of COVID infection. It's just the way people are treated. When you were first found guilty, you were led from the courtroom in shackles. You were taken directly to prison and put in solitary confinement. You were held in solitary confinement for an inordinate amount of time on a number of occasions. Mm-hmm. For what? I was sick for you reading this. I was arrested once for daring to try to ask my then Congressman Alan West a question about his vote to privatize Medicare, and thrown in jail and put in solitary by myself for a matter of hours. And I thought I was going crazy. I can't imagine what you went through, and they did this to you for what good reason? For no good reason. And there's no controls over this. This still happens every day, that prisoners are thrown into isolation and left there for weeks
let me mention this. I got an email indirectly from an inmate in prison today. I'm not going to reveal his name, of course, because it would get him in trouble,
right?
But he has been in solitary confinement for 57 days now because of COVID-19. He did not test positive. He doesn't have the virus, but he has been segregated, as well as I don't know how many other inmates have been subjected to this kind of, you know, it unnecessary. Horrible. It's short of torture for sure. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not like waterboarding, but it's not pleasant. And I spent 59 days in solitary confinement. He's spent 57 days so far. And, you know, it's just not right.
No,
what we do to
right.
our inmates is not right.
All right. Yeah, I know you want to, and we're going to go, just warning people, we're going to run a little long. Governor, I hope that's okay with you, but I want to, there's so much I want to get to. We will end on Progressive Voices at 6 o'clock at the top of the hour in about 5 minutes. This show will continue at NicoleSandler.com, on YouTube, on Facebook. It'll be in the podcast and it'll be archived. So come on over afterwards and you can hear the rest of it. I just want to let people know that we're not going to end until we're done talking. So Governor, you wanted to talk about George Floyd and the correlations to what was done to him with your case and what you learned while being incarcerated for 88 months. So go ahead.
Well, the way to correct this, and I just want to make it clear, is that we've got to flip this pronouncement that U.S. citizens do not have a constitutional right not to be framed. We've got to change the paradigm. We've got to ensure that we repeal the immunity for prosecutors so they cannot willfully and intentionally put people in prison for things they didn't do.
Mm-hmm.
We need to repeal the immunity for prosecutors for withholding exculpatory evidence. There have been 150 people on death row who have been exonerated because of prosecutorial misconduct. So we've got to correct this. People's lives are at stake. But the reason why cops who murder people are not held accountable is because the family members do not have the right to have a lawyer present in the grand jury. And that is where cops who murder people with impunity, it can be set free, mm-hmm. and the innocent can be charged.
It's incredible. So you're in prison, you were imprisoned under George W. Bush, you had the appeal, you lost on the appeal, which was just shocking because there's no way you should have been convicted. There's something else that I learned that you talk about also at the end of the book that you want to see this fixed, and I didn't know this was a thing. Acquitted conduct, time added to the sentence of somebody who testifies on their own behalf. And if you do that, you're going to be able to explain this better than I can. If you testify on your own behalf and you're found guilty, they can charge you with perjury on top of everything else, saying that if you were found guilty, you were obviously lying. Also, if there's other charges that you're acquitted of, but you're found guilty on some, you can still be sentenced for those charges upon which you were acquitted.
The judge in my case, there's more to talk about the judge in my case and why he was so adamant to see that I was convicted. But he tripled my guideline range because of acquitted conduct, matters for which the jury had found me not guilty.
Oh, my God. But
this that goes on every day, hundreds of times a day, probably, when judges add time to a defendant's sentence based on charges for which they were found not guilty, because the judge said, yeah, they found you not guilty, but I kind of think you were. So I'm going to add some time to it. And oh, by the way, you committed a couple of crimes years ago, and you know, you did serve your time in prison for that, but I think you need some more time added to your sentence for relevant conduct. And oh, by the way, yeah. And yeah, you testified on your own behalf and the jury didn't believe you. So you were obviously lying. So that's perjury, or you were trying to obstruct justice. So I'm going to add some more time.
Oh,
and,
my God.
We found you had a gun in your handgun in your nightstand. It was licensed to you. It wasn't used in the commission of a crime. Nobody's ever alleged that you had any, you know, that you used the gun ever, but I'm going to give you 5 more years because you had a gun in your house.
Oh, my God. So
So they just, and but that's not the end of the story either.
Nope.
This one, I have a chapter in my book, which you know, Saving Juan Garcia.
Mm-hmm.
Juan Garcia was my bunkmate. He slept above me on the top bunk. And I asked him one day, I said, what brought you here? And he said, marijuana. I said, tell me about it. And he said, well, I had some marijuana. I got caught in 94 and 99 or 97 and 99. Anyway, so I asked him to see the legal documents. And there was this brief by the federal government. And they were arguing in the brief that he should be given 25 years to life in prison because he was convicted in 1994 of a half ounce of marijuana or more. And he was convicted of a felony, given probation. In 1997, convicted of one half ounce of marijuana or more, and given a felony, given probation. In 1999, he was wrapped up in a marijuana conspiracy. No amount of marijuana was charged by the government, but the judge sentenced him to 25 years in prison. Mm. He served... Juan Garcia served 19 years in prison before I wrote a petition for clemency, which was granted, and he got out. But that's the kind of insane things that we do to people of color. And it is just so sad and sickening to see these young men who have been taken from their young children for piddly drug charges. Yes, they multiple drug charges. Yeah, there's another guy,
amazing,
really wonderful, yeah, decent human being. His name was Marquell. And Marquell was, I asked him, it took a long time for him to agree to talk to me about it. But in the process, this guy who was, He was a black man, African American. He was about 6'5", and he broke down and started crying because he was telling me the story about his mother, and how he was a kid and his mother had issues. I didn't go into what the issues were, but the electricity would be turned off, the water would be turned off. And he saw an opportunity to sell marijuana when he was like 11 years old. And so he went down to the street corner and, eventually was able to, get some money to turn the electricity on and the water on.
Right.
And that's how it started. And his first charge was marijuana. The second charge, I think, was marijuana. Third charge was in both of those, he was put on probation. The third charge was a cocaine charge. And because he was black,
mm-hmm,
they assumed that he was going to be making crack out of that. And so he was sentenced to 25 years in prison. And he served, I think, 23 of those. He went in when he was 23. I think he got out last year.
Just horrific.
He had two young children when he went into prison. People don't think about, in this rush to judgment, in this, for so long we were caught up in this lock them up, throw away the key mentality.
Mm-hmm.
The war on drugs, the war on crime. It was a war on men and women of color. And prosecutors took to their job with zest, and they were instructed by the Department of Justice to seek the harshest penalty, and they did. They locked up these young men for decades, taking them away from their children, their wives, their spouses, and destroying their family, and no telling what they did to those kids. And we've just got to rethink and our criminal justice laws and bring some sense into it. And
yes, we do.
We've got a long ways to go. But anyway, I hope to play a part in that. And that's part of the reason why I wrote this book, is that I want people to read it, understand it, so we have the credibility to go to Congress and argue for the changes that need to be made. To set things right.
Absolutely. Governor Siegelman, Don Siegelman is with us. And again, the new book is finally coming out this Tuesday, Stealing Our Democracy, How the Political Assassination of a Governor Threatens Our Nation. And it does. And you know, we've gone through so much of your story, but we're still not done. And you do answer one of the burning questions I had all along, which was never answered to my satisfaction. And you answered it in the book, though I'm not satisfied. And that is, you were in prison, you were prosecuted, persecuted by the Bush administration, and then Barack Obama gets elected. Finally, a Democrat, an African American. He brings in Eric Holder as his attorney general. I certainly thought, okay, there's going to be justice done here. Finally, they're going to look at this case and say, oh my God, the governor was framed. He was set up. He was railroaded. This was a political persecution. They're going to do something about it. And one of the most heartbreaking lines in the book is, I'm probably not going to find it because, okay, oh, here it is. President Obama left the White House on January 20th, 2017. I stayed in prison until February 8th, 2017. The Obama administration did nothing to help you, and I know it was not for lack of trying. I know I signed petitions and letters and, you know, as just someone out here saying this man has been railroaded, he's been persecuted. What happened? People contacted Eric Holder, contacted Obama, but Eric Holder had a connection with Karl Rove, didn't he?
Well, I don't know his connection to Karl Rove. I do know that his law firm represented Karl Rove and represented the NRC, the Republican National Committee, and there was, you know, there was a connection, and there are, you know, obviously connections between Karl Rove and Eric Holder and President Obama. The thing that bothers me about this is that they had to know what was going on. There was no secret what had happened to me. The 113 state attorneys general and a number of governors from around the country joined in trying to get the attention of the Obama administration, tried to get the attention of Eric Holder. And while they were, busy exonerating Ted Stevens, Republican senator mm-hmm. from Alaska, which they should have done,
right,
for prosecutorial misconduct, my case was riddled with far more prosecutorial and more serious prosecutorial misconduct, but nothing was done. There was one person at the Department of Justice, David Margolis, who was there when Eric Holder first joined with the justice system, the Department of Justice, after he got out of law school. And, you know, there's been speculation that he just depended on David Margolis for everything. Well, Margolis was the one who approved of this bogus charge back in 2004 that was thrown out of court after less than, you know, 12 hours because right. The judge said it was the most unfounded criminal case he had ever presided over. And then David Margolis approved of all of the charges in 2006 for which the jury found me not guilty. All of the acquitted conduct mm-hmm. was approved by David Margolis. David Margolis fired the Department of Justice whistleblower, Tamara Grimes, the paralegal, who wow. said she watched mm-hmm. as a witness was coached and cajoled and threatened, pressured to say things that he clearly didn't remember. So Margolis was up to his neck in that, but he was also up to his neck in the U.S. attorney firing scandal. He had worked with the White House, the Bush White House, to fire and replace those U.S. attorneys. I remember Dick Durbin and Sheldon Whitehouse getting very upset with David Margolis. But again, you know, while they reprimanded him, nothing was done. But he was up to his eyebrows in my case. And because of that, he was probably telling Eric Holder, no, we don't want to do that. It's going to make the Department of Justice look bad if we open this, you know, can of worms.
Wow. Did you ever hear from Obama, anybody in the administration, about why they ignored your case, why there was no pardon or clemency or anything?
No.
Nothing.
No. Never heard of it.
Unbelievable. Just unbelievable. You mentioned John Conyers, who was always in your court, who was, you know, trying to help you. Was anybody else in the Democratic Party stepping out to help you?
Well, there were a number of congressmen who were on the House Judiciary Committee, some of whom are still there, and I have a good relationship with them. But no, there was, I mean, we had, you know, we heard favorable things from Steny Hoyer was a big supporter, and John Lewis and
John Lewis.
Harry Reid professed that he was going to try to help, and we heard the same thing from feedback from Chuck Schumer, and Terry McAuliffe said that he was going to try to help. But you would think that with all those people trying to help, that something would have happened.
You would think,
but it didn't.
You know, a couple other things I want to point out is when you went back for the second trial on the appeal, the jury was hung for weeks. The judge, that same Judge Fuller, who had other problems after your case, was in the news. His instructions to the jury were very one-sided. And then when they came back and said, we can't come to, you had a couple of people who were a conflict of interest on people in the jury, who there was evidence that they were talking with the prosecution. There was all kinds of stuff wrong with this. But the judge kept admonishing this jury who was sequestered, who had been away from home for weeks, that you will stay here. He said, I've got nothing better to do. I'll stay here till Christmas if I have to, and made them come back with a verdict. This is unheard of, isn't it?
Well, it was something that shocked me when I heard him. He said, look, I've been appointed to life. I can keep you here until next year if I want to. He said, these are his words. He said, bring me a verdict or a partial verdict. And to me, when you say verdict to a jury, that means a guilty verdict.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean acquit him. So, yeah, he stepped over the line. But he and I had political conflicts going back to 19. I mean, every election he was on the other side. He was on the Republican Executive Committee. He opposed my ballot initiative to give free college education to kids. And that was the heart of my, you know, of the bribery charge,
right,
was a contribution to the education lottery
right.
referendum.
Oh.
So he should have recused. He didn't recuse. And as you pointed out, and as is in the documentary, Atticus versus the Architect,
mm-hmm.
Which is free on Amazon if anybody wants
to
watch it.
Oh, good. Okay, Atticus. I'll put a link to it.
Yeah, Atticus versus the Architect, the political assassination of Don Sigelman. But this judge is just a bad, bad person.
Horrible. And who was later...
First wife filed for divorce for abuse, and she also alleged that he was addicted to alcohol and drugs during the time of my trial. And then
his replacement wife called the cops, and there was 911 audio of him beating her, which this was while I was at Air America. I remember it very clearly, and saying, this is the judge in the Siegelman case. So then you had a perfect appeal, and you did.
Well,
you had the case ready to go to the Supreme Court, and they...
Well, we went to the Supreme Court three times, but... But I want to finish Judge Fuller.
Okay,
So this bothers me too, because this is another abuse of power.
Mm-hmm.
So here is this judge who has viciously beaten his wife with glass broken, whiskey all over the place. She's cut. She's pulled chunks of her hair out. He's hit her. He's kicked her. So there's an investigation by the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals. The investigation is sent to something called the United States Judicial Conference. It is made up of every chief judge from all of the different circuits and a few of the district court judges from around the country. They sent what is an indictment to John Boehner, who was then Speaker of the House, saying that they were certifying that they had substantial evidence that Judge Fuller, Judge Mark Everett Fuller, had severely beaten his wife, violently, I think they said, beaten mm-hmm. his wife at least 8 times before this incident at the Ritz-Carlton in Atlanta. Now, they said he had perjured himself before federal investigators, that he had lied to federal investigators. Now, we have seen other people lie to federal investigators and they are charged with a crime.
Right, right.
And if the average man or woman was charged with violently beating his spouse, his wife, they would be charged with several different felonies and sentenced to prison.
Yep.
But Judge Fuller was given anger management course allowed to retire with full benefits. And that's not the end of the story about Judge Fuller. Just one more, and then I'll drop Judge Fuller. But he had a sideline business. He was not only a judge, but he was a defense contractor.
And
he had a company called Doss Aviation. He recently sold it for $2 billion.
Oh, my God.
But during the trial, he had applied for a $174 million a year contract with the United States Air Force. And after the trial, it was awarded to Doss Aviation, to Judge Fuller's company.
Oh, my God.
$174 million each year for 10 years, renewable. And he sold the company for $2 billion.
Wow.
And so anyway, that's it's also brought out in the documentary.
Yes. And I will put a link to it on Amazon, the documentary Atticus versus the Architect. Don Siegelman, this has cost you everything. You're a public servant. You worked in government. Any retirement savings or savings you had went to pay for your legal defense. So when you got out of prison, your wife had medical issues from a horrific car accident you suffered before you went to jail. And your kids, you know, you talked about the effect being imprisoned has on families. Your kids were young. They were, 11 and 14 when this all started? And now they're adults. Your son went to law school so he could work on your case. I mean, this has derailed your entire life. And as we mentioned before, it sounds through everything, all the issues with Judge Fuller and his jury instructions and everything else, that you had a perfect case for appeal. And you did go to the Supreme Court and you were waiting for them to take the case. And they just said, no, we're not going to hear it.
Yeah, it's the we appealed 3 times. And the first time we appealed, it was based on that initial finding by the 3-judge panel that there were substantial questions of law and fact that would likely result in reversal. And so the Supreme Court at that point sent the case back to the 11th Circuit saying, take another look at this based on the actual definition of bribery. Which is not involving a campaign contribution, but where there's a briefcase of money, where there's some self-enrichment scheme. And the 11th Circuit said, no, we still think that Siegelman is guilty, so we're going to let the conviction stand. We took the issue of acquitted conduct up to the Supreme Court as well. And that was denied.
Wow.
And then we sought a new trial. We were asking for discovery because we knew that we had evidence that the lead prosecutor was emailing my Republican opponent's campaign manager, giving them updates on the investigation. So we thought if there was one email that the United States Department of Justice had, there probably were others, and they were probably link call rove to my prosecution. And of course, our request for discovery was denied. So yeah, I'm anxious for those Karl Rove emails to surface at some point, because I'm sure that we would find his fingerprints all over my case.
But now you're telling us that that Donald Trump, the orange menace, is trying to make nice with Karl Rove, so maybe he can use some of his dirty tricks in the 2020 election. We know that Trump will stoop to nothing, to no boundaries when it comes to trying to do whatever he needs to do to stay in office, because I think he knows that the minute he's a civilian again, he should be arrested and sent to jail. He would if there was justice in this country.
Hopefully they'll chain him to Mnuchin too for giving away his $500 billion to their friends and not offering any kind of public accountability.
That's right.
And this is why they got rid of all of the inspector generals.
Yeah,
they didn't want any report coming out on how they were going to, you know. And it's just awful.
And it seems like the Trump administration is following that Bush playbook. I mean, he even brought in someone to do away with anyone in the administration who's not suitably pro-Trump enough. This is not how America is supposed to be. And Don Siegelman, I'm telling you, the book just broke my heart, even though I knew the story. I knew what happened. Reading it again in this one, volume was just heartbreaking, because I see in you what we could have been, what we could have had. And there's no reason for this. And the fact that the Democratic Party did nothing to come to your defense sours me on them even more. Obviously, I have no love lost for the Republicans, and I'm not even going there. I'm just really disappointed that we don't have a party that we can rely on to stand up for the rule of law and for the really good people we have who are working hard for the people of this country.
Well, amen.
Yeah.
That's all I can say to that,
yeah.
Nicole. You have a phenomenal way of putting things, and so sometimes, the less said, the better. So
right.
I'm just going to let you be my spokesperson.
I gotcha. And I wish I could. I'd scream from the rafters, and I do, and I have. I'm so appreciative to have this opportunity to speak with you about this. Again, I've followed your case all these years. We spoke a couple of times, and I spoke with Dana while you were imprisoned as well. And my heart goes out to you and your family for what you've been put through. This should happen to nobody, nobody in this country, ever. Yet it does.
The abuse of power that happened to me happened in the halls of power in a courthouse.
Yeah.
But what happened to George Floyd and Eric Gardner and others happens on the streets of America
every day.
And and that, again, the point of my book is that we George Floyd paid the ultimate price. Now it is up to us as citizens to create new policies, new politics, and new laws to protect the most vulnerable from abuses of power by police, prosecutors, or presidents.
Without a doubt. The book, Stealing Our Democracy, is officially out this Tuesday. Do yourself a favor, buy it, read it, share it. Everybody needs to know this story. And you're right, Governor Siegelman, it's not just about you, but it is about you. Because the Republicans and Karl Rove saw somebody who was a really good governor, who was beloved by the people from both parties, who had, you know, who could have brought wonderful things to this nation. And they went after you for precisely those reasons. And this should never happen again. And what kills me is that, you know, nobody came to your rescue. Nobody is coming to our rescue right now. That's why we have to do it. We all must stay out in the streets and protest for what's right. And most importantly, we need to vote. We need to get this criminal out of office. But all our problems will not then be solved, because Joe Biden, I'm sorry, is not, a return to the Obama administration will not fix these things. The Obama administration let us down on your behalf as well. And we need to do better than that. We need to do better as a nation. Well, we need to do better as a party. We need to do better.
Well, let me close by saying this. If we're going to end systemic racism, if we're going to heal this country, then we've got to see transformative changes in our education, economic, healthcare, and criminal justice systems. And, you know, that means that in my judgment, our president, our next president, has to see that every child, regardless of where they're born or to whom, or the color of their skin, or their economic status, whether they're immigrants or whether they are citizens, that every child is able to reach their God-given potential through education. That means two things. One, we've got to have free early learning for every child. And secondly, we've got to offer free higher education for every student who stays in school, stays out of trouble, and makes their grades. They don't have to go to college, but they can get higher education, higher training, so they can get a better job, or they can go on to be an engineer. To fix the economic system, we've got to have more and better jobs. We've got to have new uses for renewable energy to combat climate crisis. We've got to create jobs for all these people who have been displaced by coronavirus.
Yeah.
There are many jobs that this country needs done that the country needs to pay for. And that means we've got to have a president who is going to face up to the fact that it is wrong when 1% own 50% of the wealth, or three families rather own 50% of the wealth, and 1% own 92%. And when large companies pay no taxes at all. So we've got to have a president who is going to fix our tax system. For decades, we've been told that it's the immigrants and it's the welfare mothers and it's the people on government programs that are dragging down the middle class taxpayers. No, it's the middle class taxpayers that are footing the bill for the 1%. So we've got to reverse that, and our next president has to address this issue. And then we live in the richest country in the world, and no one should go to bed hungry, homeless, or without health care. Health care must be a right for every American. And, you know, it doesn't matter whether you are, whether you're poor, whether you've got mental or physical disabilities, or whether you are in prison. You know, this country is big enough and strong enough to take care of you. So we need to make some changes, and we can do it. We can, if we work hard enough and long enough for this election in 2020, if the people on the streets will after they protest, will come back and will work to, if they will find a candidate, a local candidate or state candidate or a presidential candidate in whom they believe and trust and work for them and help them get elected, we can change the way things happen in this country. If we elect a good mayor, they will appoint a good police chief. If we elect a good governor, they will appoint a good prison commissioner. If we elect a good president, they will appoint good U.S. attorneys
and
good judges.
Right. Yeah.
But it is up to us as citizens to make this kind of change happen. We can make this country what it should be, but you know, we've just got to dig in and make it happen.
We got to do it. Governor Don Siegelman, thank you so much. On behalf of my listeners, because I don't really speak for more people, but number one, I thank you for all the work you've done and for everything you stand for. And number two, I apologize for letting you down, because what happened to you should never have happened. And we should have been able to do something about it. And instead, we stood by feeling helpless for years. And you served a very long prison sentence for doing nothing wrong. And that's a travesty. Everybody needs to read this book and share it. I hope you're doing a lot of press. I hope every talk show has you on, because people need to know your story, and we need to make sure that in this case, history does not repeat itself. Don Siegelman, you are a national treasure, and I thank you. I'm so honored that you chose to speak with us about this and spend so much time to go through what happened.
Nicole, thank you. I look forward to listening to your program or watching your YouTube at the next opportunity.
Thank you so much. You. And we will talk again. Please stay in touch.
I will. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Take care. Bye-bye. And with that, we're done. Don Siegelman, what a treat. What a pleasure he is. And just think of what was possible if he had not been the target of Karl Rove and the Bush administration. Just think where we'd be today if Don Siegelman had run for president in 2004. I think about it often. All right, with that, we come to the end of another week. Monday, we've got another Music Monday program with a wonderful artist named Jonathan Brooke. So we'll do our usual news and information at the beginning, and then, yeah, we will enjoy some music, because we need a break from a lot of this craziness that goes on in our world. Thank you for listening, everyone. Thanks for sticking around for the overtime. I think you'll agree it was worth it today. Have a great weekend. I will see you back here on Monday. Thank you again for listening. Peace out, everyone. Bye.